From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogay, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, a conversation about life, death, and the code of the samurai. We hear from film director Jim Jarmusch. His movie Ghost Dog is now out on video. It stars Forrest Whitaker as a hitman for the mob who follows the ancient samurai code. Also, novelist John Irving tells us about adapting the Cider House rules for the screen. It's now out on video. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new essay collections, and guest film critic Henry Sheehan reviews The Cell, starring Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Lopez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Hopes are dimming for the Russian seamen trapped aboard a nuclear sub at the bottom of the Barents Sea. A Russian rescue capsule reached the sub's rear escape hatch today, but was unable to gain access because the hatch is so badly damaged. Photos show a hatch in the front of the sub is also out of commission. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, Defense Secretary William Cohen says the U.S. is assembling a small team of technical experts for possible NATO-coordinated assistance in the rescue effort. Russia has not yet asked for NATO's help. More and bigger wildfires are burning in the West today, with some of the largest in Montana and Idaho. From member station KBSX in Boise, Jill Hoyt reports.
More than 90 large fires are burning over a million acres of forest and grasslands now. Almost half a million acres are aflame in Montana, and another half million acres in Idaho. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt was at the National Fire Center in Boise earlier today.
All the people and all the resources and all the experts have one thing in mind, and that is how we do the maximum job between now and September 15th.
Wet, cool weather is expected in mid-September. Babbitt insists he's leaving fire suppression and management strategies up to the professionals on the ground, but admits he's worried about the hot, dry temperatures and high winds forecast for this weekend. For NPR News, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise.
Aerospace giant Boeing says it's streamlining operations in a move to cut costs. It doesn't expect any layoffs, but says it will relocate more than 3,500 workers. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Kathy Duchamp has this report.
Boeing announced today it will cut factory space at plants in the Puget Sound region and Wichita, Kansas by 1.5 million square feet over the next 2 years. The 3,500 workers affected will be retrained and shifted to other jobs. The plan arrives after months of rumors that the world's leading plane maker was preparing to close a major facility. Union officials representing Boeing machinists say they're relieved no jobs will be cut, but they fear more sweeping reductions in the future. Boeing management says it wants to cut more than $2 billion in overhead and shrink its base of suppliers by 40%. The goals were adopted last summer after 2 years of disappointing financial results. For NPR News, I'm Kathy Duchamp in Seattle.
Doctors say Arizona Senator John McCain's skin cancer doesn't appear to have spread. Cancer experts say that's good news and means the melanoma can probably be treated with surgery. That is scheduled for tomorrow. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points. The Nasdaq Composite lost 10. And the S&P 500 was down 4 points. Trading was light today. 812 million shares changed hands. This is NPR. George W. Bush resumed campaigning today now that the Democratic National Convention is over. The Republican nominee told voters in Tennessee he believes Americans want a fresh start and not 4 more years of Clinton Gore. Meanwhile, Al Gore and his running mate Joe Lieberman boarded a riverboat in Wisconsin today to begin a 400-mile campaign cruise down the Mississippi. Gore told supporters the first bill he'll sign as president will mandate campaign finance reform. The alleged leader of a feared Colombian drug cartel has been extradited to the United States, despite death threats against top government officials in Colombia. From Miami, NPR's Philip Davis reports.
Alberto Orlandez Gamboa was taken aboard a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration jet bound for Miami, where he was to be transferred to New York City to face drug charges at U.S. District Court there. U.S. authorities say Gamboa is head of a cocaine trafficking and money laundering cartel based in the coastal city of Barranquilla, known as the Caracol or Snail Organization. He's just the third Colombian extradited since Colombian President Andres Pastrana took office. A loose grouping of drug organizations known as the Our Country Movement, threatened in newspaper ads to assassinate Supreme Court justices and government officials if the extradition went through. The Colombian government took the ad seriously. It sent dozens of heavily armed agents to escort Gamboa to his U.S.-bound jet. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
A volcano began erupting today on a small island near Tokyo. Japanese officials have ordered more than 2,000 people to evacuate their homes. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross.
The way of the samurai is found in death. Meditation on inevitable death should be performed daily.
That's Forrest Whitaker as a hitman named Ghost Dog, who follows the code of the samurai in the movie Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. It's just out on video. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring an interview Terry recorded last April with Jim Jarmusch, who wrote and directed the film. Jarmusch also made Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Mystery Train, Night on Earth, and Dead Man. The hitman in Ghost Dog lives alone on a rooftop and works for Louis, a small-time member of the mafia who once saved Ghost Dog's life. Louis is part of a gang of losers. In this scene, Louis is told by his boss that he has to reveal the secret identity of his hitman.
Now what the f*** is his name?
Ghost Dog.
What?
Ghost Dog.
Ghost Dog?
He said Ghost Dog.
Yeah, he calls himself Ghost Dog. I don't know, a lot of these black guys today, these gangster type guys, they all got names like that they make up for themselves.
Is that true?
Sure. He means like the rappers. You know the rappers, they all got names like that. Snoop Doggy Dog, Ice Cube, Q-Tip, Method Man. My favorite was always Flavor Flav from Public Enemy. He got the funky fresh fly flavor. Live lyrics in the bank of reality. I kick the flies, don't maneuver technicality. Do a dope track. I love that guy.
I don't know anything about that. But it makes me think about Indians. You know, they got names like Red Cloud, Crazy Horse, Running Bear, Black Elk.
The film Ghost Dog is both comedy and tragedy, a reflection on the meaning of life and death, and a study in contrast between cultures in America and between the code of the mafia and the code of the samurai.
The Ghost Dog character follows the code that he's learned from the book Hagakure, the book of the samurai. How did you come across this book?
The book was actually given to me while I was writing the script, and I had read other books about samurai culture and Bushido. There's another book called Code of the Samurai, which was written by an old samurai. But this book is particularly beautiful because it's written in like little aphorisms, and each one is separated by a little Japanese symbol called a mansho. And they're not really hierarchical in terms of content or subject. So you'll have one small text that is a very philosophical, and the next one may be about, you know, how to clean your shoes. And I really like the kind of non-hierarchical guide to being a samurai. And also the form of the book influenced the form of the film, because in the way that those little symbols separate each text in the book, I kind of reversed that and used quotes from the Hagakure as little separations in the film itself, like little breathing spaces, like almost like a little running commentary on what informs Ghost Dog as a samurai, like where does it come from.
The Ghost Dog character is somebody who was nearly killed by some neighborhood hoods, and he was saved by the small-time mafia guy. And ever since then, Ghost Dog has been the hitman for this mafia guy in return for the favor of saving his life. The Ghost Dog character, you know, in reading the Samurai book, reads this line, "Meditation on death should be performed daily. In every day, one should consider oneself as dead." And in some ways, I think that's almost the theme of the movie, this meditation on death. Tell me why that strikes such a chord for you.
Well, I started the real genesis of the project, and I don't really know why, but I wanted to make a portrait of a character that was a contradiction, that was someone whose life was very violent, who is a hitman, but we would find some reason to respect him or even like him. And in the Hagakure, or preparation for being a samurai, one is prepared for death at any moment, and that's one of the foremost, you know, elements of being a samurai or of Bushido. And why, you know, why that appeals to me, I'm not exactly sure. I'm not very analytical, but I do know that philosophies that consider death as part of life and are kind of cyclical speak to me much more directly than, for example, religious philosophies that are based on being rewarded or punished, you know, in the afterlife.
Well, when I was watching Ghost Dog, I was thinking, you must have been thinking a lot about death, because both Ghost Dog and your earlier film Dead Man are about people who have been saved from death but are facing their imminent death. And in Dead Man, a Native American prepares an elaborate death ritual for this young white man who has been shot and is dying. And this ritual is to create a decent journey into the next world. In Ghost Dog, the Forest Whitaker character has studied the Book of the Samurai and has learned to face death through that. And in a way, by facing death, he also learns how to live. I guess I'm wondering how much reading you've done about other cultures' philosophies toward death.
Well, quite a bit, and not in preparation for anything, but just out of interest. And, you know, these two particular philosophies, in Dead Man it comes from Aboriginal, North American Aboriginal culture, and in Ghost Dog it comes from an Eastern Zen culture, and both of those philosophies are very much concerned with life and death being part of the same thing. In fact, all things being one thing. So I, you know, over the years, I guess I've read a lot of different philosophies from different cultures, but, you know, I'm really not a big fan of religions or philosophies that seem to be intent on controlling people. Like the idea of, you know, I was raised a Christian. I sort of lost that, well, pretty early on when I was told that animals don't have souls, which kind of freaked me out because I had a dog and my dog had a soul. So I also don't, it seems like almost like a game show technique, Christianity. Like if you behave well in the afterlife, you'll either get paradise or you'll get the inferno. It's like, you know, what's behind door number two or door number three. It's kind of an odd philosophy to me. So I have been drawn toward those that consider things to be circular and cyclical.
So you've done a lot of reading. Have you ever immersed yourself in any of the disciplines that you've read about?
No, I haven't. I'm not very disciplined. I'm more interested in the philosophies and how they, you know, what they, how they affect my thought processes rather than, you know, really disciplined. Although there's a guy who worked on Ghost Dog briefly. He appears in the background in a scene and performs a few martial arts moves on a guy that's like trying to steal something from him. And that's Sifu Yan Ming. He's a Shaolin priest from China that lives in New York. And I got a lot of respect for him. And I may study with him on some level in the near future. I certainly would like to, but I haven't started yet. I don't know how much it would be you know, physical and how much philosophical, but he said he would like to, you know, devise some program for me specifically. Some of the Wu-Tang study with Yan Ming, and they've actually given him some money for a prayer room in his school and have been big supporters of his.
So is your interest in studying martial arts to do it as a discipline or to do it for self-defense?
It would be definitely as a discipline. For self-defense, you know, I'd rather just carry a gun.
Which you probably
don't, right?
I'm joking.
Yeah. I don't. No.
Right.
No, but, you know, it's a combination. And you see in Ghost Dog, for example, when Forrest Whitaker became that character, he studied martial arts since he was 10 or 11 years old. And in the film, when he uses his weapons, which are modern handguns, automatic guns with laser sights and silencers, he handles them like a sword. Even uses physical movements that are similar to the way a samurai or a martial artist would use a sword. And a sword is an extension of one's arm, which is an extension of one's body, which is an extension of one's chi or one's soul. And so, you know, all those things are completely interconnected in Eastern philosophy and even in the study of martial arts. So, you know, I'm interested in the connectiveness of those things. And if I do study it, it would be, you know, trying to discover those connections.
I don't know if you'll think this is a fair analysis or not, but it seems to me some of your early films, like Stranger Than Paradise, were kind of absurdist. You know, kind of searching for meaning and not sure if there was any and having a kind of absurdist outlook. Whereas your last couple of films have, like, found meaning in understanding death and facing it.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to analyze those things. Once my films are done and I've seen them with a paying audience, I really never look at them again. So I try not to, like, I don't know, to analyze my own work. I'm really more intuitive and just like to go forward. So it's hard for me to chart those things or say, you know, what affected you at what point in your life and changed your work in that way. I don't really know. I just try to keep making them, you know, intuitively. So I have no good answer for that.
Jim Jarmusch. His film Ghost Dog is just out on video and DVD. Terry Gross spoke with Jarmusch this spring. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded this April with director Jim Jarmusch. His film Ghost Dog is now available on video and DVD.
Now, you wrote the part of Ghost Dog for Forrest Whitaker. What was it about? Did the character happen first, or did you decide to write something for Forrest Whitaker first?
Well, I had a vague idea for this character, this desire to try to make a contradictory character who was violent, but we would see something deeper in him and respect him. And that was the very beginning. And then, of course, I started searching in my head, like, well, who can I imagine as this character? And Forrest Whitaker kept returning and returning. And so I called him up and talked to him. I had met him a couple of times briefly, but I called him up and said, look, I have this idea. I want to proceed writing it with you in mind. Is that okay with you? I'm not going to, you know, try to commit you to the project until I have a completed script. And he said, yeah, you know, I told him what I knew thus far. And so I started there. And, you know, what attracted me to Forrest is his presence is somewhat contradictory. He's very gentle, and there's definitely a kind of depth to him that you feel right away, and you feel it when you see him on screen. And yet he's also a big, imposing guy. He's studied martial arts. There's another side to him, and I wanted to get that kind of a balance. And it's a very difficult character to ask an actor to play, a character who doesn't talk much. He doesn't really act out. He's very centered and reserved and reactive. And Forrest is a really, really amazing actor in terms of reacting, which I think is the essence of acting.
You know, he has one eye that's kind of swollen and hooded, and, you know, and it looks different from his other eye. And I think it's a real asset for him. I think he knows how to use his eyes in such a way that sometimes that more swollen eye makes him look more vulnerable and bruised, and other times it can make him look more kind of threatening and unpredictable.
Yeah, that's true. And it, you know, and I was somewhat aware of that just not designing the shots, but I was aware of that from different angles too. But it's really something, I'm not sure how aware of it he is or not, but you know, that there's a kind of asymmetry that has a real emotional effect in his face, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In your acknowledgments at the end of the credits, you thank Jean-Pierre Melville, the French filmmaker. Tell me about his influence on you and on this film.
Well, Melville made very, very beautiful French gangster films. And what I really love about Melville is that he did mix different things together. Like, his films are very, very French in a way. Ghost Dog quotes Le Samurai that starred Alain Delon. But there are a lot, I really love all of his films. Like, he will have these French gangsters dressed in a very American style with sharkskin suits, and they drive through Paris in big American cars. And he kind of mixes things together. There's something, even his film Le Samurai, of course, was a big inspiration for Ghost Dog because he uses a kind of Eastern style. The center of the character of Alain Delon is essentially a samurai. He doesn't go as far as Ghost Dog does to give you references as to, you know, what code he follows, but he definitely refers to, you know, an Eastern way of thinking or of acting. And I don't know. I really love the way Melville mixes things together, and he's very particular in that way. But there were other films, too. There's a film that was also very inspirational, my second favorite hitman movie of all time after Le Samurai, which is a film called Branded to Kill, a Japanese film from, I think, 1967 by Seijin Suzuki, that is a really bizarre, beautiful mixture of many things. It's a black and white CinemaScope film, and it really verges at times on surrealism, but it is also certainly a gangster film, and it pretty much ended the career of Seijin Suzuki with the Japanese studio that he worked with because they considered the film to be just too strange.
In Ghost Dog, Forrest Whitaker lives on a rooftop. And he's created a little shack on the rooftop, and he lives there with a lot of pigeons. He sends messages by carrier pigeon, and he loves these birds. I really only know of carrier pigeons through movies, you know, particularly on the waterfront, which the Marlon Brando character, you know, has
right.
pigeons and really, you know, loves them, and they bring out his sensitivity. have you ever, like, actually seen a rooftop with carrier pigeons?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, not carrier pigeons. They have been extinct since 1914. But, yeah, right behind where I live on the Lower East Side, for years and years there was a coop in the building just behind mine, and I used to watch them often, especially on weekends when he'd fly them on Saturday and Sunday mornings. And it was very, very just visually interesting because when they flipped directions, depending on how the light was hitting them, they would often flip from being backlit to frontlit and therefore from black to white, and would fly in these swirling patterns. And, you know, it was some old Italian guy that had them and was always smoking cigars out there and waving his flag to bring them back down. And then in researching the film, I met quite a few different pigeon guys that keep pigeons, both in Manhattan and up in Spanish Harlem in Manhattan, and in Jersey City and other places, so in Brooklyn. And boy, I'll tell you, it's a really weird subculture of people who keep birds.
What's weird about it?
Well, they're just such strangely different kinds of people, you know? I met these guys up in Spanish Harlem. I'd really like to make a documentary film about them. They have this wild rooftop setting in an abandoned building that's like a kind of drug building. And they have like some kind of Rottweiler up there that they say is very gentle but is chained up because she'll jump on you. And they have maybe 600 birds, and they they just really two guys, really interesting wild characters. They there are birds that will, homing pigeons that will return to them. So those are the birds they choose to sell. Like they'll sell them for $5 and a couple days later they're back, you know. So they were really fascinating. Also across from them in Morningside Heights, there are some peregrine falcons that are nesting. And they sometimes come and snatch a bird from their, you know, their flock of pigeons while in flight. And they were really, you know, fascinated by that. It was horrifying to them, but they said, you know, it's all part of survival. We, you know, we got to give in order to survive as far as our birds go. So, you know, sometimes we watch some falcon come and snatch one of our birds away.
It seems that now there's a lot of young independent filmmakers who make that independent film and then land that big commercial deal and get catapulted into the world of major motion pictures. You haven't really done that world. Would you like to stay out of it or just keep going your own way?
Yeah, I'm happy being whatever I am, marginal, or as long as, you know, I am tired of being called, my films being called quirky, I must say. I think any critic or reviewer who uses the word quirky in reference to anything that's like slightly left of the mainstream should be hunted down and, I don't know what, shipped off to Gilligan's Island forever or something. But
what's so irksome about the word quirky?
I don't know. Every review, any film or record that's like alternative or whatever label they use is always called quirky. And I'm starting to get, you know, I'm starting to get ready to, I don't know, take action against the word quirky.
Well, watch out.
Yeah, I know. Like, do you ever wake up and just feel quirky? Like, I don't know. I got a quirk in my neck. I don't get this word quirky. But anyway, I lost the question.
About making it into...
Yeah, because I'm just too damn quirky.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just too damn quirky for that. No, I, you know, I didn't calculate, like, I will make films like outside the mainstream, or I will make this type of film. I just intuitively, I love the form of cinema, and I'm just trying to learn how to do it and how to use it. And, you know, this is a world where almost everything is valued, or its value is assessed in the marketplace, which doesn't interest me. And I don't know, I'm just not really... I think I would make very bad commercial films, or I'd end up in jail for having to work with, having people tell me how to make a film. It's just not my, it's not my strength, that's for sure. So I'm going to keep trying to do what I do as long as I can, and eventually if they stop me, I don't know, I'll figure out something else to do.
Director Jim Jarmusch spoke with Terry Gross this spring. His film Ghost Dog is now available on video and DVD. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the challenges of adapting the novel The Cider House Rules for the screen. A talk with John Irving. He wrote the novel and the screenplay. It's now out on video. Maureen Corrigan reviews two new collections of essays, and Henry Sheehan reviews the film The Cell.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Even the best newspaper columns are ephemeral, read in the morning, tossed out with the trash in the evening. But two new collections have preserved, between hardcovers, some memorable essays by the roving literary journalist Ron Rosenbaum and the legendary New York Herald Tribune sports writer Red Smith. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews both.
The literary category, summer reading, usually conjures up images of a big fat novel, heavy on plot, light on ambiguity. But there's another kind of summer reading for us vacationers to lose ourselves in, reading that's often more intellectually stimulating and at the same time more compatible with, say, the choppy rhythms of a beach house shared with kids. I'm talking about essay collections that you can dip into for short periods and then resurface with your brain cells tingling. Two collections I just sampled have almost nothing in common, except the most important thing of all. They're both chock full of good writing. And what makes writing good? Well, as Ron Rosenbaum would say, let's not fall easy victim to the dream of decipherment. Instead, I want to mull over that big question as I consider new collections of both Rosenbaum's writing and the writing of the immortal sports writer Red Smith. Rosenbaum's essays are immensely learned and funny, as well as quirky and cranky, two adjectives that usually go along with a third, affected, but in Rosenbaum's case, don't. I always emerge with at least the delusion of being smarter after reading a Rosenbaum essay, and so I feel really brilliant after perusing The Secret Parts of Fortune, a collection of 30 years' worth of essays on everything from the odes of John Keats to the enigma of evil that is Adolf Hitler to the secret rites of the Skull and Bone Society at Yale. Rosenbaum's trademark method is to pair old-fashioned close readings of his subjects with wide-ranging allusions to everything else under the sun. For instance, in an essay here on Kennedy assassination conspiracy theorists, Rosenbaum tosses in asides on Aldous Huxley, Kierkegaard, and the classic Saverin coffee commercial featuring Alexahente. In the hands of lesser writers, this hectic referencing becomes a cheap trick, a way to say, look at me and how idiosyncratic I am. But Rosenbaum, as a writer, is neither cheap nor tidy. He likes to leave ideas lying around. In that Kennedy assassination essay, which was written in the 1980s, Rosenbaum ultimately comes to an uneasy acceptance of the Warren Report. But then here's what he says in a postscript. 2 decades after my inconclusive conclusion to this story, one mystery of the assassination continues to deepen, the mystery of Oswald. He may have been a lone gunman, but there was never a lone Oswald. Almost all of Rosenbaum's essays end with paragraphs that could be subtitled Case Open. Thinking about things is just too much fun for Rosenbaum ever to call it quits. Speaking of unsolved mysteries, I'm still clueless about the national pastime of baseball, and I've tried for years to get it. Red Smith, the man many claim was the greatest sports writer of them all, once wrote that baseball is dull only to dull minds. Yeah, well, he would say that. He only obsessed about the game in print for decades. Red Smith on Baseball is a collection of some of his great columns from the 1940s to the 1980s. And the amazing thing is that even to a dullard like me, Smith's baseball writing is compelling. His smarts about people, his hard-boiled sentimentality, his understated morals. No wonder Hemingway was one of Smith's famous admirers. Here's his lead for a piece about the 1948 World Series. It was a day when malice lay over everything, thick as mustard on a frankfurter, and you could reach out and feel it like something tangible. The Yankees, killed off by the Red Sox yesterday, were out here in Fenway Park to gouge back an eye for the one they had lost. And the Red Sox, inspired by the loftiest sort of cupidity, wanted that World Series money so badly they could taste it. I haven't forgotten about our home run question, what makes writing good? In the case of these two essayists, I think it's the sense that they're earnestly trying to capture something elusive and true in their writing, and that they're not constantly nudging us readers to applaud their efforts. And as for how they produce such good writing, well, I'll quote Smith. He once said, "There's nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at the typewriter and open a vein."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, John Irving on the trials of being a novelist in the movie business. This is Fresh Air. The Cider House Rules is a movie adaptation of a novel by John Irving. It won two Oscars this year. Michael Caine won for Best Supporting Actor, and Irving won for Best Adapted Screenplay. Irving worked on the movie for 13 years, with a total of four directors. Lasse Hallström ultimately directed the film. In Irving's recent memoir, My Movie Business, he explains why it took so long to make the movie and offers some insights into the differences between writing books and writing films. Earlier film adaptations were made of his novels The World According to Garp and The Hotel New Hampshire, but Irving didn't write those screenplays. The Cider House Rules, which is just out on video, stars Michael Caine as a doctor at an orphanage. He also delivers the unwanted babies of women, babies who will remain at the orphanage, and he performs abortions. His apprentice, played by Tobey Maguire, is a young man who grew up in the orphanage and has learned how to deliver babies but won't perform abortions. Here's a scene with Caine and Maguire early in the film.
First pregnancy?
Yes, for both.
I presume you prefer handling the delivery?
All I said was, I don't want to perform abortions. I have no argument with you performing them.
You know how to help these women. How can you not feel obligated to help them when they can't get help anywhere else?
One, it's illegal. Two, I didn't ask how to do it. You just showed me.
What else could I have shown you, Homer? The only thing I can teach you is what I know. In any life, you have to be of use.
Terry spoke with John Irving last January. He said that the Cider House Rules was inspired in part by his grandfather, Dr. Frederick C. Irving, an obstetrician who graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1910.
He was the chief of staff of the Boston Lying In, which was the country's foremost maternity hospital. He was a professor of obstetrics at Harvard. I know him better through his writing, through his several books on obstetrical and gynecological procedure, than I ever knew him as a kid. I can't recall, in fact, a single intimate conversation with him. He died Christmas Eve when I was 15. So it's through his writing that he made a principal and powerful influence on me for reasons that are still unclear to me. I was 14 at the time. I felt certain that I wanted to be a writer. It was about the time I started reading Charles Dickens, my earliest fictional hero. And I told my parents I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, and they said, "Oh, you should read your grandfather's books. Then he's a writer." I'm not sure that obstetrical and gynecological procedure was entirely suitable for a 14-year-old.
Yeah, but, what was it like for you at the age of 14?
To riveting.
Were there illustrations of gynecological surgery and of childbirth and things like that?
No illustrations, except for the fact that he wrote very descriptive, if Victorian, prose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned more about human reproduction from those books than I probably learned in school for, well, maybe ever.
Do you think that reading your grandfather's Victorian language and describing medical procedures affected the way you thought about the body or later wrote about the body?
That's a good question, but I've not thought of it before. I don't know so much that I was affected in that way as that the life of a doctor of medicine at that time, and an obstetrician, gynecologist in particular, was one that I could imagine in full detail, so that in the early 1980s, when I began research for a novel about an orphanage physician and his relationship with an unadoptable orphan who's born in his orphanage and who is repeatedly unsuccessfully adopted, I had already in mind the kind of detail that I was looking for, the kind of detail that I would find. The surprise, of course, was the abortion subject, because I hadn't set out to write a novel in the case of the film of the Cider House Rules, a screenplay that was on or about the abortion subject. It was the relationship of that old physician and orphanage director and this unadoptable kid that I had foremost in mind. But when I began to read the histories of abortion and the histories of orphanage hospitals and the lives of orphanage physicians, that procedure and the life of an orphanage hospital was inseparable, of course. Understandably, because if any physician, qualified physician, would take the risk in those days when that procedure was illegal, if any physician would take that risk and perform that procedure, who else but someone who had the sympathy for the condition of those women who came there and left children behind? And more importantly, or just as important, the fact that many of those orphans would not be adopted. The older they got, the less likely it was that anyone would take them, and they would eventually become what at the time was called wards of the state. That made a powerful impression on me, and I decided that the issue of performing that procedure or not performing it would become a crucial area of conflict between the young orphan whom the old physician apprentices, whom he trains to be a doctor, that would be a point of contention between them. Not that the orphan would ever disapprove of the old doctor performing abortions, nor would that orphan believe that women shouldn't have the right to have an abortion if they wanted one. It's just that he didn't want to perform the procedure himself. That is the argument of the story. It is by no means the current political so-called right to life or pro-choice argument. The novel and the film of the Cider House Rules is unequivocally pro-choice.
As you point out in your memoir, you created a compressed version of the story of the Cider House Rules for the screenplay. And you say the passage of time is so important in your novels, but that's not easily captured in a film. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in how time elapses in a novel as compared to on the screen?
I felt it was essential in taking a long novel and bringing it down to film size. And so the first decisions, the most radical decisions, were what were you going to lose? Who are the characters and their attendant storylines that had to come out of the story whole? Because I feel strongly that if you can't honestly say that a character has the same emotional effect on an audience that character had on readers, that character shouldn't be in the story to begin with. If you're only going to marginalize that character's emotional effect, lose the character. Those were essential choices and, painful ones, but the most radical decisions of what to cut out of the Cider House Rules were made before I'd collaborated with the first of these four directors. They were made when I wrote the first draft of the screenplay. I made them myself.
Is pruning your own novel to make a screenplay a little bit like performing surgery on yourself, you know, that you're too close to it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a matter of how wholeheartedly or not you believe in the potential of the novel to be a film in the first place. In some cases, I look at my novels and I just don't see the potential film that's there. Or if I do, it seems too much of a compromise at the outset and I'm not interested in it. The thing about the Cider House Rules that made it instantly attractive to me as a potential film, almost from the moment the novel was finished, is that unlike all of my novels, or unlike most of the others of my novels, it was the sixth. I've written nine. I'm finishing a tenth. But it alone has the symmetry that only a journey away from home, which ends up back in the same place, can have. And symmetry is very gratifying in films. It's very gratifying. And it had, in other words, a structure that was instantly visual to me at the outset. I could see that orphan coming back to that orphanage. That was always the end of the story. And I could see it in film terms. I believed in its possibility as a film, which is why I wanted to be involved not only as a screenwriter, but to have approval of the director, to have approval of the cast, to ensure that the director had approval of Final Cut, all those things that writers aren't generally afforded, and which, in the case of other novels of mine made into films, I really haven't been concerned enough to ask.
Did adapting your novel, The Cider House Rules, into a screenplay lead you to reconsider any of your opinions of your movies that were adapted by other screenwriters?
No, I like those films. I like George Roy Hill's The World According to Garp. I like Tony Richardson's The Hotel New Hampshire. I just felt detached from them. I liked Mark Steven Johnson's Simon Birch, as it was called. I simply didn't think it was close enough to the novel to be called A Prayer for Owen Meany, or to use the names of my characters. And Mark and I were in agreement about that from the moment I read his screenplay. I just felt it was too divergent from my novel to use my novel's titles or the names of my characters. Contrary to everything I've read, wherein I'm described as alternately despising the film or whatever, I liked Simon Birch. I just didn't think it should be called A Prayer for Owen Meany, and it wasn't.
In the 13 years that it took to actually get The Cider House Rules to the screen, did you lose interest? Did you ever feel, I'm just really sick of this?
No, you don't lose interest in an experiment as long as you don't change your mind. The experiment was, I've seen films of my novels made other ways, namely by letting them go. Let's see if I don't let one go, how long it takes, and if it'll ever get made. I was prepared at the outset that the film would never be made, but I knew that if it were ever made, it would be made with my approval. And so that was the game. If someone had told me at the beginning it was going to take 14 years, I might not have been so eager to play the game. But once you start, I don't think you can back out. I mean, you've got to be faithful to something and follow through on it. And however long it takes, I intend to do the same thing with The Son of the Circus.
When you're on a plane or a train and you see a passenger reading one of your books, do you introduce yourself?
No. No, I kind of hope I won't be recognized. I wouldn't want to interrupt them from reading the book. They're much better served to be reading the book than they are to be having a conversation with me.
Say they're just carrying the book, and they're not reading it at the moment you see them. Wouldn't say anything?
Well, that would make me cross, yes. I would think, what are you doing instead of reading this book? I did see, I had the misfortune once of seeing a woman on a plane back from Los Angeles, actually. I was traveling with my eldest son, and a woman across the aisle, diagonally across the aisle, was reading The World According to Garp, and at some point, she closed the book and stuffed it into the air sickness bag in the little envelope in the seat in front of her and never took it out again. And my son was dying to draw her attention to the fact that the man who had offended her so was sitting right across the aisle. So we had a very tense trip all the way to New York, but I was never identified as the culprit who had written the offending passage. Whichever one it is that made her close the book, I'll never know. But it was a highlight. I'll never forget it.
Well, John Irving, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Irving, from an interview Terry Gross recorded in January. The Cider House Rules is just out on video and DVD. Coming up, a review of the new movie, The Cell. This is Fresh Air. Jennifer Lopez enters the mind of a serial killer in the new horror thriller, The Cell. Film critic Henry Sheehan tells us how in this review.
Moviegoers may be forgiven if they sometimes get the idea that the human race has been reduced to, on the one hand, the professions, and on the other, psychotic killers. In one movie after another, doctors, lawyers, highly trained law enforcement personnel, or Hollywood's favorite, architects, are forced to grapple with enthusiastically perverse murderers. The crucial factor in all these dramas, whose mama is Silence of the Lambs, is that the hero or heroine, despite having spent a life's work in the courthouse, at the drafting table, or tracking down everyday crooks, has a special mental link with the drooling killer. So when I say that in The Cell, Jennifer Lopez plays a child psychiatrist named Catherine Dean and Vincent D'Onofrio a psychotic killer named Carl Starger, I've told you nearly half of what you need to know about the movie. I can finish off the description with two words, virtual reality. Virtual reality in the movies means the creation of sets, backgrounds, costumes, effects, and even characters through computer technology. The Cell, like The Matrix, uses this technology to an extreme, putting its characters into what is supposed to be a succession of mental landscapes, each radically different from the one before. The reason is that most of the movie is spent inside Starger's mind. We end up there because the psycho has just been arrested after kidnapping his latest female victim. The FBI, led by a hard-bitten but young agent played by Vince Vaughn, hope to learn from Starger where he hit her, but the killer goes into a seizure-induced coma. There's only 40 hours until the victim succumbs to Starger's fiendishly constructed booby trap, so the FBI trots the killer's body over to Catherine Dean's lab. The doc has been experimenting on entering the mind of an autistic child. Now she's got to enter Starger's sleeping consciousness and figure out where he stashed the girl. Virtual reality is the most Barnum-esque technical advance in film history, at least when you look at what it has promised versus what it has delivered. For example, once we get into Starger's mind, everything on screen looks loony as hell. Everyone walks around in elaborate costumes. At times, the whole movie looks like Lopez's personal fashion show, with fanciful, through-the-looking-glass dresses featuring push-up bras and protuberant bustles. D'Onofrio, never what you'd call a quiet or studied actor, gets to do one of the maddest John Malkovich imitations since being John Malkovich, all the while dressed as a satyr, a mad king, a regal devil, or other various incarnations of Carl Jung's workbooks. In Hollywood, you can never be too young. But does this virtual world differ from ours in any non-superficial way? Well, let's listen in on this exchange between Vaughn's FBI agent and Lopez's colleague, played by Dylan Baker.
So she's made contact.
Oh, yes. She's gone very deep into his world. Time's too far.
It's cold.
That could be dangerous.
What are you talking about?
Well, if she came to believe that Starger's world is real, then theoretically her mind could convince her body that anything that was done to it there was actually done. It's like the old wives' tale.
Right.
You die in your dream, you die in your life.
Henry, could you raise the temperature in here, please?
Dr. Kent?
Just a moment, please.
Dr. Kent, can I come in there and speak with you, please?
We have to be patient. I mean, look at her. She's drowsy. Let her wake up.
We don't have a lot of time. Do you understand that?
So Starger's mental landscape isn't all that different from any other movies. It's just the same old, girls with guns chasing boys with toys. Unfortunately, director Tarsem Singh is, yes, you guessed it, a commercial and video director making his feature debut and has all the shortcomings associated with his crafts. The worst here is an inability to pace his film for the long haul or to establish any continuity of suspense. Every interlude spent in one or another's characters' minds plays like a self-contained episode. About the only links between them are those supplied by sentimentality and sadism, the cheapest coins of the horror film realm. Because this is an election year, The Cell may well catch some notoriety for one particular scene. It takes place when the G-Man joins Catherine in one of Starger's nightmarish realities and ends up locked down on a torture table by the killer. Stargher takes a pair of scissors, cuts open his victim's stomach, pulls out an end of an intestine, attaches it to a barbecue spit, and begins turning. Aside from being the dime store version of one of David Cronenberg's brilliant visions of horror, as well as a cheap way of getting a rise out of Joe Lieberman and Bill Bennett, this scene has little impact. It takes place within such an aura of unreality and happens between characters of such skeletal substance that it's like watching one paper doll cut up another.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Learning Network, providing online learning tools and development programs for teachers, parents, and students. On the web at learningnetwork.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Why We Hurt, a conversation with neurosurgeon Frank Vrtacic about the pathways of pain in the body and treatments for relieving it. He has a new book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.